Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and we have a great show for you this week. InQtel CISO Dan Gear will be along for a very interesting conversation about the major cloud providers. Are they too big to fail in the way that some banks are too big to fail? Does the efficiency of highly concentrated ownership of a large chunk of the world's internet service capacity make it less resilient? We talk about that and more in this week's feature interview. I think you will like that one. This week's sponsor interview is also an absolute cracker. We speak with Mike Hanley of Duo Security. Mike is the Senior Director of Security at Duo. And he's along this week to talk about Google's BeyondCorp initiative. Really, BeyondCorp is Google's vision for the next generation of enterprise environments, and it has a lot to do with deperimeterization. Mike is along this week to talk about that concept and how solid authentication is basically the first step in moving towards that vision. It's really, really solid stuff, so do stick around for that one. But of course, before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, before we get going, I should probably point out that both you and I are suffering a little bit from the B-Sides Canberra conlurgy. I think I may have been patient zero for that one, given how ill I was feeling at the time I did my...
Damn guy. Damn
yeah, you. Sorry about that, everyone who is sick. So everyone bear with us while we try to muddle through. The first news item this week, if you are to fly into the United States from a whole grab bag of countries from this day forward, apparently you can't take your laptop into the cabin, which is, you know, pretty inconvenient, I guess. But all sorts of people are floating this theory that that's so that, you know, the TSA can clandestinely mirror your discs while your laptop passes through your checked luggage. And I got to say, I'm calling bullshit on that theory. What about you?
Yeah, that really does not seem like a plausible sort of thing to me. I mean, yeah, it doesn't. It's, you know, even from a practical perspective, unpacking everyone's bags and looking for laptops and then limiting and putting them back in again, it's just not a practical way of doing it. It makes a whole bunch more sense to do in the context of going through, you know, with check-in baggage when you can actually assess the person as well as the... as the luggage and have a conversation. For example, what is your password, sir? Or would you like this rubber hose? It does not seem like a reasonable thing. The other suggestion, the one that's being put forward, is that there is some specific intelligence relating to a plot using bombs hidden inside electronic devices, which, you know, Occam seems fairly firmly on that side.
And if you know how, you know, lithium ion batteries show up on, on x-rays and stuff, it kind of makes sense that would be a good way to smuggle explosives into an aircraft. And, you know, people say, well, what difference does it make if they're in the cargo hold? Well, you know, if it's only a small charge, maybe you need to position it next to the skin of the aircraft or whatever. And, you know, the fact that the UK has also implemented the ban would tend to lend a bit of credibility to the theory that this is in response to some specific intelligence.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the cloning your discs or trojaning your boxes argument is true in this particular case.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, I never thought that was an InfoSec story until, of course, people on the Twitters started trying to make it one. Let's just move on from that. Oh, now, look, WikiLeaks being a bunch of dicks again, which I guess we're not too surprised about. Of course, they did this big song and dance some time ago saying that they were going to coordinate the disclosure of the security vulnerabilities that were relied upon by, you know, the CIA's toolkit. What they've done since, though, is they've tried sending over these agreements to Google and Microsoft saying, you need to sign these agreements before we'll hand over the bugs. And, you know, the agreement, frankly, has some reasonable stuff in it, like, you should, patch these within 90 days or whatever. But Assange sent over these documents knowing that these companies wouldn't sign them, cue grandstanding. So now he's saying, well, Microsoft has, cleared personnel and does a lot of work for the intelligence agencies of the United States. So therefore, that's why they're not signing these documents and whatever. And it's all just a big pile of grandstanding bullshit.
Well, exactly. And we don't even really know. I don't think anyone has seen yet, you know, exactly what the full set of demands is. We've heard about the, you know, specific requirement for a reasonable disclosure timeline, but we don't know what the rest of the demands are and the extent to which they're reasonable. And even if they were reasonable, it's still got to go through legal in a big company like, you know, Google or Microsoft.
Yeah, and
Apple.
I'm guessing signing a document with a WikiLeaks letterhead, you know, on it is not exactly something that the Microsoft legal team is going to really enjoy.
Well, no, and it's not going to be a fast process regardless. Like, that's not a thing that's going to turn around in a day, you know, a day or two. So, yeah, it really doesn't, you know, it does not seem like it's in the best interests of everybody whose boxes are going to get owned with, you know, ridiculous Cisco Telnet bugs, which we'll talk about in a second, I'm sure, from the stash. But, yeah, grandstanding, unfortunately, rather than, you know, actually getting on with it.
Well, and, you know, Assange has said, well, these are all industry standard demands, but, you know, Google doesn't make Microsoft sign documents before they hand over bug info. They just go public after 90 days, and WikiLeaks could, of course, do the same thing. So in this case, it really feels like they're just trying to make, they're trying to slow down the process and make it look like the vendors are slowing down the process so that they can then criticize and grandstand. So, you know, as I say, I just think it's just political bullshit. And I think, look, I know that we have listeners in the intelligence community, particularly in the technical side of the intelligence community, and it would be just wonderful if the CIA might consider disclosing some of these bugs themselves directly to the vendors, just to short circuit this mess. Dan Guido is one of the people floating that idea, and I think it's a good one.
Yeah, no, I think that would be a responsible thing to do, and yeah, kind of cut some of the bargaining power out of WikiLeaks' access to the stash.
Yeah, and also, you know, WikiLeaks saying that they won't want to patch them because they don't want to piss off the CIA. Mate, you know, they patched the Stuxnet O-Days, you know, they patched the Flame MD5 collision. That test has been and gone, and yeah, the vendors passed it, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they absolutely passed it. So, Julian, you just be quiet now, please. Now, you know, over the last couple of weeks on this program, we've been floating the theory that there may have been a major incident. I caught, you know, rumors, informed, educated speculation, I guess I'd call it, that there may have been some sort of major incident at Microsoft that has delayed their February patch Tuesday. And, you know, we're actually starting to see the rest of the tech press pick this up, which is interesting. There's a bit of momentum building on this one.
Yeah, Dan Gooden ran a piece over on Ars Technica where he asked Microsoft for some comment as to what had happened to their patch Tuesday. And they, of course, got back to him with, you know, the marketing version of absolutely nothing to say here, sir, please move on. And yeah, as you say, the speculation is spreading, you know, beyond the walls of this podcast and onwards into the wider press. Yeah, Microsoft still, of course, has said nothing. And yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. Or, you know, someone will come and, you know, and tell you what they know.
And it's not like people haven't been asking. That's something to make clear. Even I have put requests through to Microsoft PR and got met with the old big void. No reply whatsoever. They wouldn't even give me a no comment. So that's interesting.
Not even free credit monitoring? Oh, damn.
Yeah. Oh, God. God. Cisco. you know, I mean, we like to think of, you know, intelligence agencies having to use really sophisticated stuff, but it ain't always the case.
Yeah, apparently there was a bug, a real humdinger, actually, in Cisco iOS. It appears to be mostly the Cisco Catalyst kind of switches rather than the routers, but there was a bug in the like cluster management process that they used to kind of handle load balancing and sharing of config state amongst switches that are operating in a cluster. Anyway, apparently it did that over Telnet, and it turned out that these particular interfaces were actually exposed on the like main management Telnet service, like not restricted to some special internal cluster communications, you know, cable or something. And yeah, net result is there was a bug in it and you can pop all sorts of things with it. I haven't actually seen the exploit or specific details of what they are, but Cisco has an advisory out. They rate it like 9.8. We're using the CVSS metric, which I think is CVSS for oh shit. And yeah, it's pretty bad. And I think the bug in the actual CIA stash, it's called like, I think, a truffle hunter or something. So like a, you know, big pig rooting around, snuffling up all of the sweet shells on the Cisco switches.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's interesting, times. Right, that Cisco were able to identify this bug not from seeing the tool itself, but just by reading the information that was dumped by WikiLeaks. They were able to divine from that this was the problem.
Yeah, no, that is certainly interesting. And I guess that there must have been enough hints to give their engineers an idea where to look. And then, you know, presumably the bug was a fairly glaringly obvious one and they found it in a fairly quick time.
Yeah, but good job, Cisco, you got to say, right? That's being proactive in all the right sort of ways.
That is. Well, of course, they could also not have had the awful bug in the first place. That would also be good.
That would also be grand.
This is second best.
But, you know, we are where we are, Adam. So let's just, you know, half a biscuit, I guess, for the team at Cisco. Turning our attention to Krebs on security. And look, just after we published last week's show, four men were charged with the Yahoo attack, which is kind of interesting. The Department of Justice has indicted a bunch of people who, you know, obviously won't be extradited to the United States because they will stay in Russia. But they did get their hands on one of the suspects, which is interesting.
Yeah, there was this guy, Karim Baratov, who is a Kazakh national and Canadian dual citizen living in Canada, who has apparently been picked up. He was running, without much in the way of OPSEC, a bunch of services for hacking people's mail accounts and other, you know, kind of usual underground hacking sorts of things. And he appears to have been roped in to help out with the intrusion into Yahoo by some people affiliated, people who worked for the FSB. And yeah, it seems like this is where at least one of the intrusions into Yahoo's systems that resulted in the stealing of the, you know, the cookie forging code and the subsequent access by the Russians came from. So yeah, interesting bit of extra detail to that story from the compromise, you know, back, what is it, 4 or 5 years ago now. And yes, he, at least one of these guys is now picked up. The rest of them, I imagine, although one of them is the guy that got arrested for treason that we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, it's all very messy over there in Russia. But yes, there's big FBI wanted posters for the rest of them. So they had better not travel anywhere.
And the indictment is a gripping read, let me tell you, because it also explores who the targets were of this this attack. And, you know, everyone from journalists, you know, prominent Ukrainian figures, business figures in Russia, and all of that. So, you know, it seems pretty clear that this, you know, you would think, why would Russia want to hack Yahoo? And the indictment spells it out in no uncertain terms.
Yeah, no, there's a, you know, number of interesting targets there. You know, people who work for a prominent Russian cybersecurity company. Gee, I wonder who that could be.
Yeah.
And and yeah, all sorts of, you know, investment banking firms, a Swiss Bitcoin wallet firm, a US airline. Yeah, lots of all the things you would imagine that someone like the FSB would be interested in.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and it also looks like, you know, it might have been kicked off with a spearfish, which none of us are terribly surprised by that. moving on to Wired now, and Andy Greenberg, among others, actually, this story's doing the rounds because it's based on some research done by Checkpoint in why basically using the web browser versions of things like WhatsApp is a pretty bad idea. I mean, I don't use the browser version of something like WhatsApp because I think it's, you know, it's pretty nice actually having it end-to-end on one device. And once you start throwing, you know, browser connectivity to your WhatsApp, it seems like a pretty crap idea. And this kind of validates that thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a, you know, there's a general understanding, or at least there probably ought to be a general understanding, that, you know, it is a significant increase in attack surface. And the bugs that the Checkpoint team were demonstrating are one in the web version of WhatsApp, one in the web version of Telegram, basically involve, you know, attacking the larger attack surface of the browser versus the, you know, more constrained implementation that's running on the mobile device, and then using that to get, you know, some kind of script injection and then onwards to access to the device, to the messaging inside the application. In the case of the WhatsApp one, it's a like view image, and then, you know, that's the end of it. The Telegram one was a little bit more involved. You had to kind of like click on a playing video, so it wasn't super slick. But as a general, you know, example of the dangers of using, you know, full HTML, you know, browser-based interfaces to access these things. I mean, there was a talk at KiwiCon which had similar sorts of approaches to compromising thick client messaging applications, you know, through the through these kinds of, you know, through the browser, the fact that their interface is a browser. So yeah, it's a result of the increase in the attack surface, and yeah, it's the impact in the case of WhatsApp is pretty bad. You know, access to all of the messaging and the photos and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, end to end is great when you have one end on each end.
Well, you know? Yes, and when you trombone that end out into a browser next to your phone, not so
you don't hear us often talking about ends-to-ends communication, right? Ends-to-ends encryption, because that's not what it's all about.
Multi-ends.
Yeah. A lot of action on the bug bounty front this week. Both Microsoft and Intel are offering up to $30,000 now for criticals, which is kind of cool. Invite-only programs, but still, you know, pretty good.
Yeah, Intel, I mean, this is Intel's first foray into bug bounties for its hardware. So, yeah, up to 30K for hardware through the HackerOne platform. They are, and I think it's quite telling, perhaps, that they are specifically excluding all of the Intel security products, i.e. McAfee.
Yeah.
Probably because they don't have enough money to pay out $30,000 for every McAfee bug. But, yeah, it's definitely a good start. I mean, the widespread existence of bug bounty programs, you know, really is just good for the industry as a whole, you know, both in terms of quality and in terms of giving hackers something to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was this bug, ThreatPost reported on, someone owned up GitHub with a pretty sweet code exec bug, and they got an 18K bounty, which is a nice score. Like, especially if it's something that you come across, you know, somewhat opportunistically, like that's real money. You can have fun with 18 grand, you know?
Yeah, this was a guy who apparently was just kind of pottering around with the enterprise version of GitHub and found that bug. And yeah, 18 grand for something you just kind of stumble across while you're mucking about is, yeah, that's good money.
Yeah, Better than a kick in the proverbials, as they say. Oh, and Pwn to Own, there was a, you know, absolutely awesome bug took down Pwn to Own. You know, Kihoo 360, of course, found this just epic end-to-end thing that went from here to there and through VMware Workstation and Windows 10. And please tell us.
It was, yeah, this was a really cool bug chain. They overflowed, they did a heap overflow in Edge, which is already pretty difficult, Edge being, you know, a fairly robust browser, certainly by comparison to IE before it. And then they popped Windows kernel privesc to escape the Edge sandbox and get up into the kernel's type confusion bug. And then, yeah, for the pièce de resistance, they popped bug in VMware to escape the VMware Workstation hypervisor and get up into the bare metal machine, which is, yeah, a pretty good time. So they made good money for that too. $105,000
Yeah, and you just sort of wonder if Elon Musk is going to come along and offer him some money to try to break out of the MeetSpace hypervisor, you know, because we're all living in a simulation, don't you know.
Pwn to Own gave out a whole bunch of cash this year too. It was like a couple of $100,000 the first day, $300,000 the second. So yeah, there's a fair amount of money being thrown around on. So yeah, some really cool bugs, not just this the one that got all the attention, the Gihoo one.
Yeah, so bounties are certainly where it's at this week. Now, someone who's trying to do a creative bounty for credential recovery, Joseph Cox got this story about someone who's popped a whole bunch of Apple, you know, iCloud accounts. They've got a whole bunch of iCloud creds, and they want to sell them back to Apple for something like $75,000, which, or, you know, $75,000 in Bitcoin or Ethereum, or $100,000 worth of iTunes gift cards, which I think is super interesting, right? You know, give us that money and we'll delete this data. I don't think they're going to see the cash, so I think we should be bracing for a little bit of credential exposure going on here. But points for trying, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a creative way of monetizing. This group is called the Turkish Crime Family, so at least they got that bit figured out. And yeah, I don't think they're going to get the money either. Whether or not they do actually have the one story they claim they had 300 million creds, another one they're claiming 559 million creds. You know, if they drop those, that would probably be a pretty bad day for Apple. You know, certainly a more than $70,000 bad day. But yeah. I don't know that unsolicited bug bounty programs for your stolen data is really a thing that Apple wants to get into.
No. Just as signing an agreement with WikiLeaks isn't probably something that Google or Microsoft want to get into. Oh, look, this next piece is on Motherboard. Joseph Cox wrote it, and it looks like Joseph went on a bit of an FOI binge trying to get more information on dark market takedowns and the roles of various agencies in some of the bigger busts. And what he found is the information that came back from like DEA. So there'd be this big bust and it would be like a whole group of police forces and they'd say it was a joint operation with DEA. And then DEA have come back and said, yeah, no, we didn't actually have anything to do with that. And they just used our name for press release purposes. Like straight up just honesty in the response. Like, no, this was just marketing.
Apparently, also the one of the other records he got was talking about the Central California Darknet Strike Force, which was announced by one of the U.S. Attorney's offices in California. Turns out there is no such strike force.
It did not exist. It was a name created by an assistant United States attorney for press release purposes. The strike force does not exist in DEA. Isn't that just beautiful, right? So, yeah. ThreatPost running a question as a headline, but it's a damn good question. Where have all the exploit kits gone?
Yeah, no, it is. It's interesting. If you talk to anyone who works in the financial industry and have been tracking, you know, how people are getting their bank accounts and internet banking jacked these days, yeah, it's not exploit kits anymore, which, you know, 2 years ago was absolutely not the case. And, ThreatPost have got a kind of a write-up as to what their theory is of, you know, where all the exploit kits have gone. You know, and I guess the short version is a bunch of them have gone away completely because of arrests or busts or pressure on that area of the industry. A bunch have gone kind of underground and smaller in their focus rather than being, you know, easily available on forums for people to buy. And some have just been replaced, or it seems like the bulk have been just replaced with Office macros because it's the year 2017 and that's how we do it these days.
But yeah, I mean, alternative headline for this could have been cyber criminals reconsider cloud strategy.
Yeah, no, I think like certainly macros are in the, you know, whichever of the Gartner Magic Quadrants is the right place to be. I don't know.
Yeah, we need to anyway, do, that's where we macros should are these do days. That. We should do a Gartner Magic Quadrant for owning stuff. Do you know what I mean? Office macros spear phishing, you know, is that in the magic quadrant? Probably cost effective. Anyway, all right, we've got another one from Motherboard here, which is kind of interesting. Carnegie Mellon University in the United States. Now, this is, of course, the university that helped the FBI own Tor to bring down a whole bunch of, you know, hidden services that were doing some pretty nasty stuff. So I'm a bit less judgmental than others when it comes to that. But Carnegie Mellon also helped the government access a high-profile iPhone linked to a terror incident, which... You got to think has got to be the San Bernardino iPhone, so maybe it wasn't Cellbrite, but they haven't actually named the case. But it's just an interesting little thing that we'll keep an eye on, right?
Yeah, there was no real information that it was specifically Cellbrite. There was kind of rumor and stuff. But yeah, this Carnegie Mellon Group is certainly another contender, and I can't think of another high-profile case that we've talked about more than the San Bernardino one, so perhaps it was.
Yeah, you never know. Ah, US CERT has pointed out something that you would think is kind of intuitive, but it's just good to see them do this. They're saying that, you know, inspecting TLS, like, on your LAN, you know, like, decrypt, re-encrypt, isn't a particularly good idea in a lot of cases because a lot of the kit doesn't connect out using great ciphers and kind of weakens your connections and whatever. So it's just interesting to see that advice coming from the US government, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that obviously those of us who know how these things work would say it's, you know, it's clearly a bad idea for a bunch of reasons. But yeah, it's nice to see something like the CERT actually saying it and articulating the specific concerns, you know, namely that they don't validate the certs well on the devices when on the outbound leg, that they don't necessarily report errors on the outbound leg well on the inbound leg, and that, yeah, the configuration of these devices in terms of their cipher settings and stuff is not often ideal. Which, you know, it's good to see rather than just being sort of just general spooky fingers defense, which is, you know, what you get from a lot of people who are doing TLS intercept.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, obviously the primary reason you want to do that is to get visibility into your traffic. But, you know, just the more we look at it, the more it looks like, you know, moving controls and detection towards the hosts is just a much better way to do that. That's why I'm really curious to see how Collide goes with its commercial, you know, version of OS Query or the commercial tools they're building around OS Query, because that's where it's got to go.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously. I mean, the compromises are happening at the edge of the network. I mean, the middle of the network really isn't the focus for attackers very much at all these days. I mean, you know, passive intercept, you know, was a thing that SIGINT agencies did and everybody else kind of did, like, on occasions. And yeah, it's dying in the network, and the edge is where everything is.
The edge is where it's at. Oh, comedy story of the week. A whole bunch of people's Twitter accounts were hijacked and used to send out pro-Erdogan tweets and also some pro-Nazi tweets as well, including a few people in the security community. And it was because they were using this Twitter, like third-party Twitter app called Twitter Counter. So people had authorized it and then Twitter Counter got popped and, you know, the rest is history. But it's pretty embarrassing, right?
Whoopsie, yeah. It's not a good look at all when UNICEF is tweeting about, you know, Nazis and stuff.
Yeah, I think it was one of the bloggers at Sophos too got popped with it and wrote a post saying, yeah, sorry, I'm not actually a Nazi, which was pretty funny, and that was his mea culpa. Tavis Ormandy has been doing a little bit more with LastPass. One thing I've noticed about this, though, is his tweets have been a lot more restrained, and he's actually started saying things like, look, you know, use a password manager is bad advice, but, you know, use a good password manager isn't bad advice. And it's nice to see a little bit of nuance creeping into his discussion on this stuff, because I couldn't agree with him more.
Yeah, no, Tavis does certainly, you know, feel like he's going to rock up with a stick and just going to smack the vendors right in the face. So a little bit of nuance in the face smacking going on now. Although this particular bug in LastPass is quite a fun one. If you go and read the bug tracker in Project Zero, essentially you could get either code exec or read the creds out of someone's LastPass through a mechanism of talking to their browser plugin. But yeah, when he provided the proof of concept to them, it wouldn't trigger. It turned out because it was triggering calc.exe, as you do when you're a hacker, and they were running on a Mac, which did not have calc.exe. So
no.
Took a little bit of extra time to figure out that one for them.
Oh, and run, don't walk away from running Adium at the moment.
Yeah, Adium and, of course, other messaging clients built on the libpurple library are having a bad day. There's a bug going around in that. It hasn't actually been patched in Adium yet because it bundles, apparently, an old version of libpurple with it. It has been patched in some of the other messengers. But, yeah, using a thick client instant messenger these days really is a pretty high-risk thing. I mean, that code base has been a disaster for, you know, the last 10 years. So, yes, probably consider some other way of instant messaging.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like they posted info on this bug into a mailing list, like the developer mailing list, expecting it to be patched, and it was more like crickets. So you sort of wonder if maybe the people behind that project have just got too busy doing other things, and you know, this might be the death spiral for Adium. Who knows?
Yeah, and probably should be. I mean, that code base is old and pretty rubbish.
Yeah. Now, of course, before we go, we were both at B-Sides Canberra, and there was a CTF down there, and there was a bunch of young people competing in this CTF, calling themselves Code Cadets, and they were young, right? They were teenagers, and they found legit Oday in the CTF gear, which was awesome, right? Like, you don't expect that, and it was just so great to see some kids basically owning stuff sideways, and it was all very, very happy. It made me very, very happy.
It was a beautiful thing. I mean, as you know, someone who's organized CTS in the past, like, it's one of the things that you simultaneously fear and really look forward to, that someone's going to show up and pop something you didn't expect them to. And of course, the extra hilarious thing is that this was actually a security product that they popped a bug in, and one with, you know, a history that's not so great. But yeah, good times. They're going to have some fun dealing with disclosure to the vendor there, because the vendor is not particularly well known for being great for dealing with. But yes, they will learn a valuable lesson about both hacking and Oday and responsible disclosure.
I have socks older than those kids, so learn from this unnamed
vendor. I've used socks proxies older than those kids.
Yeah, socks proxies older. Hey, I see what you did there. All right, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week. Feel better, bro.
Thanks. Yeah, talk again next week, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, before we continue, I thought I'd update you on some of the other stuff we've got coming up on risky.biz over the next few weeks. In coming days, I'm publishing another Soapbox special. This time it is with Senryo, who, as many of you would know, make IoT security stuff. Now, what's really interesting about that, though, is they're attacking the problem from a bunch of different angles and solving a bunch of different problems for a bunch of different people. It's sort of like a ecosystem-wide solution. So whether you're a CISO dealing with an IoT-heavy environment like a hospital, or you're a CISO for an ISP and Mirai caused you some dramas, or whether you're an embedded device manufacturer looking to improve the security and visibility of your devices once they're in the field, you know, you'll really want to listen to that one. And that one will be up, I'm guessing, early next week. Also coming up in a couple of weeks will be our first ever Snake Oilers podcast. And that's where we get 5 vendors together to do 10-minute pitches for their products. And yes, they are pitches, sure, but the whole thing basically consists of no bullshit product information. So if you're a technology buyer, don't miss that. We've got 4 vendors signed up for that one already. But yeah, if you'd like to be vendor number 5, do let us know. It is not often you get a chance to pitch 16,000 information security people in 10 minutes for really not much money. So if you're keen to get involved in Snake Oilers or to do one of our Soapbox specials, do email sales@risky.biz for some more information, because I do have a feeling that once the first Snake Oilers goes out, the remaining 3 for the year are going to fill up pretty quickly. So don't dawdle, people. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Dan Gear of InQtel. For those who don't know, InQtel is essentially the technology investment arm of the US intelligence community, but Dan has been around the InfoSec space for decades. You know, I consider him InfoSec Yoda, and he has a habit of continuously saying mind-bogglingly insightful things. So I spoke to Dan for about 45 minutes earlier this week, and I've edited that conversation into 2 interviews. Next week, you'll hear his thoughts on machine learning, but this week, we're talking about cloud service providers. In the wake of the great S3 outage of 2017, a bunch of people looked back to Dan's seminal 2003 paper, Cybersecurity: The Cost of Monopoly. That paper, which actually got him fired from AtStake because he was mean to Microsoft in it, basically argued that concentrating 90% plus of the world's commerce onto one desktop platform could be a recipe for disaster. In light of the S3 outage, some people were saying that you could take that paper, substitute the word Microsoft for the word Amazon, and the whole thing still held together pretty nicely. I wondered what Dan's thoughts were about that idea, though. So I asked him, and here's what he said.
Well, it is what it... This is a sort of lame thing to say, it is what it is, but the point of the monoculture thing is that it generates common mode failure. And meaning where one thing fails and another thing fails accordingly. And it is the lack of a, well, if we were talking about a forest fire, the lack of a fire break. You know, what is it that's going to keep this malady, whatever the malady is, from spreading? And the answer is some sort of diversity, like a firebreak, over which the contagion, like a forest fire, cannot jump. And I don't know quite how to describe it further. I mean, yes, at the time I wrote the Microsoft thing, it was, what, 95% or so of all the desktops had that platform on it. It's less the case now. But it seems to me that we're walking right into the same thing with the cloud providers, because they have a structural advantage. And a structural advantage is simply that economy of scale is a feedback mechanism, and it is going to be hard to enter that space soon, I think, unless you have really an awful lot of money to burn.
Well, I mean, I think that's why it's largely going the way of Google, Microsoft, and Amazon, right? So, I can't imagine anyone, given that there's a commodity element to it, I can't imagine anyone else coming in with pockets deep enough, even groups of investors, to be able to come and make a dent.
Unless for some reason the People's Liberation Army in China or something. I mean, that's the scale you'd have to be to enter the game at this point. And tomorrow that'll be harder, and the day after that it'll be a little harder than that, and so forth. So we are down to, let's say, three. And three is not so bad. In fact, I think economists, don't they have a rule of threes that a mature industry typically has, you know, three providers, three car manufacturers or whatever, and in a given market? I think there's some, and again, I'm not studied in economics, but I think there's an economic rule of three. And we're definitely at that spot with, the major cloud providers. Now, let me just say something that I wrote something a little while ago, and the idea still strikes me as one that we should think about, and that is, in 2008 and thereafter, starting, of course, in the U.S., but not just here, but starting in the U.S., there was a general financial brouhaha, a meltdown of some sort, if you want to call it that. There were lots of reactions to that, but one of them, from a regulatory point of view in the U.S., was to start talking about entities that were systemically important financial institutions, meaning, which is a polite way of saying, too big to fail.
Mm.
If they are systemically important financial institutions, they got a special deal. And the special deal was the whole business about stress testing. We're going to posit a situation that would be sort of dreadful, and I can't really remember this off the top of my head, but it had to do with a massive property value decline, a massive increase in unemployment, and a collapse in the financial market. I forget exactly how it went, but there were only three conditions, if I remember correctly. And the three conditions were ones that you could sort of imagine happening, like 20% unemployment, like a 50% reduction in the stock market, like a 20% fall off in real property. You know, if I'm remembering right, that's roughly what we're talking about. And the question was, would your loan book survive? Would you survive the losses that would represent on your book of loans? And that idea of doing a stress test, a hypothetical experiment in which a bad thing happens, in fact, three bad things happen at once, and could you survive that, is something that can be proven by a sort of mechanical process of saying, well, we got these many loans, and if the rate goes to this, then we're going to have these many defaults, and you know, so forth. I think we need something similar now in the space that we're talking about. And if I may coin a phrase, a systemically important network institution as opposed to financial. So a systemically important network institution ought to have some sort of, if you want to call it that, a stress test, like, let's say 30% of all the desktops have to be reinstalled by hand, and a sustained, I'm making this up, a sustained 50% drop in available bandwidth.
Mm. A loss of X amount of storage.
Yeah, and a loss of one of those three cloud providers.
Mm.
Now, would your data-centric, would your, you know, machine learning, would your big data world survive such a thing? Are you yourself sufficiently protected from the simultaneous occurrence of three bad things? And if you're a bank, you had to do it in one way. But it's not like we don't depend on, you know, a certain number of these providers just as much as we depend on the banks. The banks, of course, banks are a special case in a variety of ways, not the least of which is that they do business with each other, whereas I sort of doubt that Amazon and Microsoft do a lot of business with each other, for example. Now, that being said, the other thing that banks have that we don't have elsewhere is, frankly, they or their masters can print money. You know, if you lose enough money, you'll end up printing some. I don't know what the equivalent here is in this space, but we do need, I think, some sense of a stress test applied to a fraction of the economy, whether we're talking about banks on the one hand or the network service providers on the other. We need some sort of evaluation of that so we could say, would your business model, which we, by the way, happen to depend upon, would it survive the following three or four, small number of things, something that's plausible that could all happen at once.
Like a loss of S3 combined with maybe something else, right? And I totally understand where you're coming from, but then doesn't it become a bit of a question about capacity? So between all three of you, say one of them just space aliens came from Mars and removed one of the big three from the mix, would we even have enough capability to replicate what we had previously been hosting with that provider that is now on Mars, if you know what I mean? And that's an interesting question.
That's an awfully good question. I got a number a while ago, and again, I'm getting old enough where when I start quoting things, I really wish I had it in front of me, if you know what I mean. But 10 years ago, I believe the idea was you could fill all the world's storage, you could fill it in 2 days using all the world's bandwidth. And now it's more like a year that the amount of storage compared to the amount of stored data compared to the amount of bandwidth, the amount of stored data has grown much faster than the amount of available bandwidth, where before maybe you could, you know, move all the world's data through all the world's bandwidth in a couple of days. And now it might be a year. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you, one, the big data thing is for real, but it also tells you that, well, you better hope you don't have to do that.
Yeah, especially at the same time that everybody else is trying to do that, right?
Well, yes, exactly. Which I suppose, you know, we could sit here and do a what-if kind of thing and go on all night, but the sun could certainly knock out some satellites and some electric power one of these days. Probably will, you know, a big enough solar flare pointed right at us and, you know, bad things happen.
And you're going to lose all of the data centers in one particular region, which will have a cascading problem affecting a cloud provider. And then what do we do then?
For example, if something like that happened, then the demand for the remaining capacity would certainly price itself upward pretty quickly. That's for sure. And as we all know, the only real test of your backup system is it there when you need it? And I don't know about you, but I've had the experience of going to backups that as far as I knew, were perfect and discovering that they were far from it. And, of course, that's my fault or any system administrator's fault when if you go to the backups and they're not there, even though you thought they were there and, the health meter, whatever your health meter is, kept saying that they were there. The real test is, are they there when you need them? And of course we would have some surprises in that regard as well. Why wouldn't we? You know, that always happens. I go to start the car on a bad day and the car doesn't start in addition to everything else, you know. That's where not so much monoculture per se, although it is a good word and most people understand it intuitively, it has to do with, are there alternatives? And are the alternatives one that share a failure mode with the primary? So if your primary and your secondary both fail for the same reason, it doesn't really matter if you have a secondary. Or put differently, in the case of redundancy, a lot of people prescribe redundancy for problems like I'm sort of talking about. But in the event that it was on purpose by a sentient opponent, redundancy doesn't help. Because if you have two things and they are both on separate power, they're on separate networks, they're on blah, blah, blah. If they share a code base that can be attacked, it doesn't matter whether they're redundant. In fact, it's probably worse if they're redundant because now, you know, more is down at once. I just don't know how to fix that because, of course, economics works in the direction of, what you called a minute ago, commoditization. Yeah. And there's no doubt that from a point of view of how do we think about this? It is becoming a commodity. Computing per se is becoming a commodity in the way that at one point it was a surprise that electricity became a commodity, or it was a surprise that any number of things became a commodity. Well, now this is, and it is priced accordingly, and it is a control by a small number of players, because the more it is like a commodity, the less it is possible for someone to enter the game late.
It is true. I suppose, though, that one thing that separates this from being an out-and-out commodity is, I was having this conversation with someone recently where, okay, if your disaster recovery plan has to factor in that your cloud provider might go boom, you know, as much as we say that it's these services are commoditized, being able to re-implement your entire online presence with a different provider, the differences between the way that those providers implement things is substantial enough to make that a real headache. I wondered if you agree.
I've never tried to do that, honestly, but I bet you're exactly right. I bet that there will be, if you move from one to another, I bet you there'll be a gotcha that is just a little bitty thing. It's like just, you know, you're standing there and you're at a baseball park. You drop your drink, you bend over to clean up a little bit, you sit up and you get hit square in the middle of the forehead by a fly ball.
Yes.
And who saw it coming? And, you know, and the odds of that happening are very slim. I mean, you're just one head in the crowd, but it can happen. It can happen. Yeah. I'm sure it's on camera somewhere.
Well, I just can imagine, you know, there's just subtle changes in the way that these cloud providers roll, right? So, you know, it's all very well and good to say, well, you know, we've got this fantastic agile thing and we'll just spring it up over there. And, oh, all of a sudden our application is spitting errors and doesn't work. And it's not going to be that easy. But let's get back to these stress tests for a moment, because I think that's a really interesting idea. It seemed that you were framing them in terms of, if you're an enterprise, you need to be factoring in the potential failure of cloud providers into your own stress testing. But I'm wondering if you also think that some of these big companies that host so much of the world's information and applications and you know, a lot of the world's transactions and businesses is done on these platforms. Do you think it might be up to various agencies even to apply these stress tests to technology companies in the same way that government agencies apply stress tests to financial institutions? Do you think there is a role for government to start setting limits there or tests?
That's a good question. I imagine that the most unarguable reason for government to do it with finance and the big institutions is, if one of them screws up sufficiently badly, it affects the ability of government to function.
Could we not argue the same thing for Amazon or Google?
And I think that we're headed that way. Certainly, there are plenty of parts of my government, and I suspect yours, that have come to the conclusion that this, that, or the other function can be done better, safer, cheaper, et cetera, not on premises, but elsewhere, in somebody else's premises, not on yours. And that idea that it's cheaper, it's more reliable, it's safer, I can't keep up, I can't find good people, blah, 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 it's all true. But when you do that, you probably lose the ability to revert. It's probably a one-way choice. I am going to outsource my whatever it is. You probably can't get it back. So the question would be, are we now where on the one hand, a failure of a bank of sufficient size does affect the ability of government to function? Are we in a similar, or will we soon be in a similar position where the failure of a certain kind of digital service available over networks would interfere with the ability of government to function? And my guess is, if not now, soon.
Mm. Well, and it's not even direct impacts on government that you've got to factor in. It's secondary impacts, like you know, the failure of Azure would have an impact on the finance sector, which would then in turn, and the transportation sector, and all of these critical sectors, which would then have an impact on the government. But I just sort of wonder, I wonder how you can convince a huge company to start building spare capacity to prepare for a disaster that might not ever come. Because frankly, these businesses are very good at running their operations.
It probably won't. Won't ever come. On the other hand, there was a seminar, a full day workshop, or I guess you call it a workshop, in New York City in October of 2014, which I know because I actually attended. And it was run jointly by Morgan Stanley and the Santa Fe Institute. Are you familiar with the Santa Fe?
I can't say I am. I'm sorry.
It's where the study of complexity is in so many words centered. But it's the study of complexity. Anyway, Morgan Stanley and the Santa Fe Institute did a joint workshop in New York. And the title of it, which I think I can reproduce, is Are Optimality and Efficiency the Enemies of Resilience and Robustness? And think about that for a second. Is optimality and efficiency, which is, of course, everything there is to say about commodity, is in those two words. Are those the enemies of resilience and robustness?
Well, the immediate word that springs into mind is yes, absolutely, especially in the context of this discussion.
Right. And so in some sense, all the speakers answered yes in their own way. That was roughly the message, is that if you over-optimize, then in fact, it will be to the detriment of resilience under some circumstance that perhaps is unlikely, but nevertheless, were it to occur, you would discover that this was the case, that the optimality made the resilience diminished.
That was InQtel's Dan Yoder Gear there. Big thanks to him for that, and I really hope that nickname sticks. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Mike Hanley, Duo Security's Director of Security. Regular listeners would have heard us talking about Duo in this program long before they were a sponsor. Duo makes really, really sweet multi-factor authentication software. The company was founded by Doug Song and John Oberheide, and Duo is, extremely well-regarded and a great example of what happens when people from an offensive background jump into defensive tech. I have no problem absolutely recommending that you look at their technology and really, really consider investing in it. As you'll hear, they do multi-factor auth, but they also look at device integrity. And they've made it all really easy to deploy and to use, but today we're speaking with Mike about a broader concept than just authentication. Google has been championing something they call BeyondCorp recently. It's a vision of the enterprise computing environment of tomorrow, where networks are deperimeterized and access to internal and external applications is treated equally. Now, obviously, a key plank in that strategy is authentication, which is why Duo has been all over this stuff. But their contribution as an enabler here is, in fact, significant. If you want to move to a BeyondCorp-like environment, technology like Duo's can really enable that. It's a really, really sensible first step. So Mike Hanley joined me to talk about BeyondCorp and auth.
So BeyondCorp is effectively Google's term for their deperimeterization of their internal corporate infrastructure. You know, the traditional model for network security and perimeter relied heavily on having a sort of finite number of access points, that you had a very large stack of gear where you've got firewalls and IDS, other inline traffic inspection to try to protect the network. But once you moved past that initial stack of gear, you effectively had sort of broad access to the internal network. So you put a lot of chips, if you will, on sort of those VPNs and firewall appliances. And as part of managing that large stack of gear, you have a proportionately large number of people who are responsible for configuring it, maintaining it, looking at the alerts that it's spitting out, et cetera. So it actually becomes a very sort of complex proposition to manage and
trying to figure out what those alerts mean, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well. And your average sort of small and medium or even mid-market business doesn't necessarily have the resources to run a 24/7 security operations center with 50 guys watching the scope. And when you look at like Google's BeyondCorp model, it effectively eliminates, by sort of inverting that network, and eliminates a lot of that stack infrastructure at the gateway by simply saying, we'll expose these services to the outside world and then rely on sort of a set of really strongly, you know, strongly identifiable properties. So for example, what do we know about this device and its health? And, you know, by extension, its ownership. So you can sort of construct some notion of trustworthiness about the device. And then what do we know about the user who's trying to authenticate? So, you know, is it Patrick trying to access an application that he's actually entitled to? And can he prove it's actually him? So some things that we know about the user. And then we worry significantly less about where it is that they're coming from. And this is a great reflection of the fact that as more and more business is done in the cloud, whether or not you have a hardened external perimeter actually matters significantly less. I mean, you know, for an internal example, we have a lot of remote employees who probably never touch anything that lives in any sort of on-premise component of our internal infrastructure. They solely interact with cloud services. So even if we had hundreds and thousands of dollars in gear and a team to monitor it internally, it's not necessarily the case that that actually adds anything to our security properties or infrastructure,
I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is the simplest way to describe the starting assumption here is that you just treat your LAN like it's the internet and then build accordingly, right? I mean, that seems to be just the simplest way you can think about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the next thing on top of that too is, you know, you might say, well, how do I manage if I have 50, 60, 100 different cloud applications or, if my users are really sort of aggressively adopting new cloud applications? Well, you know, having a capability to provide that uniform policy or if you choose, do some sort of tiered access policy. So you could say, you know, for example, like we do internally, any of our employees can access, for example, their payroll information from a computer, so long as they authenticate and two-factor to log into that. But more sensitive systems, for example, maybe our code review system, they need to actually come from a device that our internal security team is actually blessed and tagged with a device certificate so that we can both authenticate the user strongly, authenticate the device, and then also make an authorization decision based on whether or not that device is running the most up-to-date software. So we can provide them feedback and say, yeah, it's you, but you're not coming from a trustworthy device, or it's you and you're coming from a trustworthy device, but you know, you need to run, you know, latest and greatest version of software to be compliant with policy. So we can actually sort of have that flexible tier of access control based on how much trust we want to assign both to the user and to their device. You know, the big thing that you can think about with having this advantage of transitioning to a architecture where you can apply policy to on-premise applications and cloud applications is if you do that via sort of a uniform tool set, it really is an enabler for the security leader for the organization to express their risk tolerance in a much, much more simpler way, right? So rather than saying, well, I have a firewall over here to protect this system, and that reflects something about the sensitivity of that data or its access rules. Or, you know, I have a host-based intrusion prevention system on this particular server, and it's set up with this configuration to protect that information that resides there. You can instead say, you know, for these tiers of sort of the sensitivity or control that I want to have over those assets, you know, here's one tier, and boom, I just sort of broadcast that policy around the, you know, N different applications that share that common set of sort of security properties that I want to have established. And then next tier down, express my risk tolerance for that in the form of a single policy suite. And then boom, send that out to all the, you know, the next tier of applications that are protected by that. So it's really, like I said, having that uniform layer there to express whether it's on-prem or cloud and solely think about what's the risk to the business. And
what's the information, right? So it's like ACL per information type, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of infinitely less, or I should say, it's you know, significantly less complex and painful for a security leader to say, you know, what are the things that I'm trying to protect? How am I doing that? And sort of what are the most important properties about either the devices, the users, or both that I want to make sure are enforced at access time every time?
In the ideal BeyondCorp world, you're not really making any distinction between internal and external applications when it comes to strength of authentication and whatnot, right? You're trying to make it all sort of uniform and just, you know, again, the mantra is don't trust your network. But, you know, I mean, that's where everyone wants to be, but it's not where most enterprises are, as far as I can tell from the conversations that I have, right? So how does one start moving towards this model in as much of a pain-free way as possible? Because it's real easy to say, hey, you know, if we're going greenfields, this is the way to do it. But, you know, there's like, you know, 11 billion legacy shitware apps running on NT4 in VMware, you know, on VMware hypervisors throughout all these orgs. So, like, where do you start, I guess, is the question. Where do you start with this? How do you make this your strategy?
Sure. I mean, you know, certainly to your point, a lot of organizations, no matter how small or large or agile or not agile that they are, will have some amount of legacy IT burden. To your point, it's very hard to just simply sort of flip a switch and say, we're a pure play, completely in the cloud, everybody's running a Chromebook type environment where we have sort of this very limited attack surface of all of our endpoints and all of our data is protected by those third-party
And there's nothing
providers.
To move laterally through because we got rid of all of our file and print servers. You know,
yeah, and at the same time, we got rid of all the adversaries too, right? They didn't even exist anymore. So I mean, to your point, right? Like that's sort of this utopian vision that you know, while we'd like everybody to maybe eventually get to that point, that transitionary period is very hard, right? And you might simply say it's untenable to just throw out all of our legacy applications. So, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do at Duo is in releasing Duo Beyond, which was our most recent major product release, we did put out something that we called the Duo Network Gateway, which is effectively that user and device sort of checkpoint to cloudify those on-premise applications. So you work progressively toward a unified experience, regardless of where something is hosted, whether it's on-premise or in the cloud, and still provide that common set of controls, right? So again, you can sort of make more strict or less strict, or sort of provide additional trust or less trust in users and devices, depending on sensitivity of information and the work that's being done, rather than on things that are much sort of harder to control for, like the integrity of the transit, right? The network that's actually tying all that together.
Or the integrity of the infrastructure that ties all of that together. And, you know, if it's some piece of Oracle crapware, right, sitting on your network, that's not something that you can let people get near. Okay, yeah, so that's why, you know, it sort of feels like you've almost got two problems at that point, because you're trying to do this new whiz bang cloud stuff and you've got all of the existing legacy problems to deal with as well. So, you know, what I worry about, I agree that this is a great model, but what I worry about is that some people might sort of be a little bit paralyzed because it's not in the short to medium term, it's not going to reduce their workload. It's going to increase their workload, right?
Yeah, but potentially though, I think the nice thing is if you, depending on your approach, you can really help put your users to work by giving them good feedback and making it easy to have sort of that discretionary performance, if you will, of choosing to do the right things and choosing to be a participant in your own corporate security. Like, so for example, by giving users helpful guidance and making it easy for them to always choose the more secure route. So whether it's saying, hey, you know, we see you're using Internet Explorer 7, which, you know, by the way, is still unfortunately quite common, right? Because people often choose legacy support and compatibility over security. But by giving people those helpful guidance and helpful hints and setting policies that say, hey, you really should be on this and here's the reason why you're doing it. Like internally, we've actually found that, you know, our employees universally all sort of opt in favor of making those secure decisions. And often we just have to sort of give them that friendly nudge or reminder by saying, hey, looks like you're missing the latest Chrome update. Restart your browser to pick that up and you'll be set.
One thing that I find funny, Mike, and correct me if this is wrong, because it may well be, right? But it feels like a lot of organizations are more likely to apply two-factor authentication to external stuff than they are to internal stuff, which just seems crazy to me. You know, Mark Piper Pipes did a great talk at CrikeyCon a few weeks ago where he was really talking about what red teamers do. There was a great slide that he put up, which is he said, this is what we do. We get creds and we own stuff and we hate duo push. Right. So, and I figured, you know, I had to tell you that because, you know, that's what every vendor wants to hear is, you're actually making my life difficult. And then we're all having a little chat afterwards when they're like, oh man, when you see that and you see that there's second factor prompt and you're like, please don't be push. Please don't be push. Please don't be push. Yeah. But is that the case that people are sort of, much more likely to sort of be 2FA, keen on 2FA because, for things that are outside of the organization, because they feel, oh, because they're outside, they're less within our control. So that's where we need to apply additional controls. And they don't really think about the lateral movement aspect that 2FA can help with internally.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually a really good observation, right? And I think it stems back to the thing where we sort of started talking about, which is that a lot of people still do have trouble letting go of their perimeter gateway stack, if you will, right? There's sort of this still, this, you know, if I have all these flashing lights and appliances in my server rack that, that controls all the ingress egress from my intranet, that, that's gonna make some substantial difference. And in fact, it is so easy to sort of do some of that lateral movement to the point that you were just making about, once you get those credentials, you have a lot of freedom of movement. And that's why completeness and aggressiveness of deployment can actually sort of work in your favor. Like we, I was just talking to some customers last week at some fairly large institutions. You know, in many cases, these are 40, 50,000 user deployments where they said, yeah, like we rolled it out in a week. And part of the reason that was so helpful is because sort of immediately bubbled up any issues and we had two help desk tickets. So I think there's generally a hesitancy to say like, oh, well, let's only deploy this where it's easy, or let's only deploy this where it'll be quick. And in fact, making the transition very quickly and having the experience uniform, whether it's an internal sort of on-premise application or a cloud-hosted application, is actually really, really nice because then users are better at saying, hey, I didn't get prompted, or this looked different. And they're much more likely to sort of raise a flag, right? Because generally, again, I think a lot of employees are sort of motivated to try to do the right thing if you at least educate them on why it is they're going through that extra step.
I think it's funny, right? Because essentially what we've got is a two-factor authentication company saying that the first step in really, you know, enabling this sort of future vision of, you know, cloudified everything is to get your shit together with auth, which usually means 2FA, right? But yeah. It's basically impossible to disagree with you that that's going to be your best first step.
And it's a challenge too, because it's, you know, I mean, it's reflective of a little bit of where we're at as an industry, right? I mean, we have sort of bought into a lot of very fancy solutions that solve really interesting problems. But at the same time, we've, you know, sort of the royal we've very much neglected a lot of the basics, right? I mean, sort of the device hygiene.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talk about machine learning enabled threat intelligence, yeah, when we aren't using, you know, when we're using single factor auth and, you know, password, ridiculous password policies and stuff, right? Like, yeah, I hear you, man.
And it's certainly not to say that that stuff doesn't have a place. I mean, I think it certainly does, especially in sort of the most mature organizations. But I think the problem is the order of execution and prioritization is very, very different, right?
Well, and another interesting factor to this is once you get your auth together and once you've got a, you know, like that, what you said before, you know, everyone's using Chromebooks, it's a deperimeterized network, everything's in the cloud and your auth is all there and great. Your ops team disappears. You don't really need one anymore, right? Your ops team becomes Amazon or Google or the people at Azure, right? So, you know, that's where it gets interesting. And then you don't need your blinky light boxes anymore. Sorry to a bunch of my sponsors for saying that, but it's kind of true. You know, I'm pretty sure you got 10 or 15 years of legacy sales to look forward to, but...
Yeah, I mean, you know, the nice thing is you can certainly get to a point where you do sort of obsolete some of these items because you actually do take advantage of the native capabilities that exist in the platforms. Like I'll give you a great example. I mean, I only sort of partially joke about Chromebooks because we're actually a fairly heavy Chrome OS shop internally at Duo. And one of the things that Google did last year that there's also sort of relative parity in terms of features on Windows 10 for is you have this concept of remote attestation where you can make this very, very strong hardware-backed set of claims about whether or not the device is in a compromised state or not. And the cool thing about that is...
Is that with some sort of, you know, onboard crypto like hardware magic?
Yeah. So, yep. So you leverage the you know, the TPM or some other hardware backed crypto module to sign those statements about whether or not the device passes things like verified boot or it has a certain set of policies applied. And the cool thing is, I mean, that really sort of gets us over a major burden about whether or not we trust the inventory and the configuration of a device, right? So for our Chromebooks internally, it's the case that if anybody ever failed one of those device checks, I mean, it would be sort of an immediate, like very, very high quality signal that something was wrong. And
it's funny though, right? Because I mean, what you're describing sounds, you know, great, right? And I'm sure you do use it internally because you have a bunch of really smart people working for you. And, you know, like no one would say that Duo doesn't have, you know, an amazing staff of very smart people. But I got to ask, right? Like for customers, I'm guessing most of them are just buying the simplest of the simple stuff, right? And they're not really going that far yet. Is that right? Because it just seems that, you know, RSA getting owned and sort of, you know, they let their 2FA stuff get so stale, it sort of created this gap into the market and Duo's come in and is, you know, not only just sort of gone way past what they were doing, but is like really launching into the future. But how much of it is just selling the real basic nuts and bolts? Is that the bulk of Duo's business?
So, I mean, you know, for two-factor, I mean, you bring up an interesting point about sort of legacy factors, right? So traditional hardware tokens where you would read back a one-time passcode. You know, I think where Duo's made it really easy for a lot of our customers to buy is we do set people up well for that uniform experience, and we do make it easy to roll out. And, you know, you mentioned Duo Push earlier. The great thing is, like, that's a very easy end user experience, right? I mean, I get a push, I see some information about the authentication, and then I choose to accept or deny that. And well over half of all of our customers use that. But back to the point about devices. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, there's sort of a very large, long tail of the distribution in terms of what classes of devices people use, both for like mobile devices and more traditional sort of thick client endpoints, where, I mean, we literally do see periodically sometimes stuff all the way back to Windows 2000. We see very early versions of Internet Explorer. You know, we see Android handsets that I'm surprised still hold a charge. So, you know, I mean, it's incredible how much hardware and software sort of configuration diversity that we see. So, you know, it's certainly true that as much as we would maybe like it, not everybody's running out and sort of buying a Chromebook or buying a Windows 10 machine and taking advantage of some of those, like, you know, more sophisticated.
But I guess what I'm hearing here is that you've gone past that, you know, that basic little problem of actually getting the second factor out. Okay, that's done. Now it's really looking at device integrity as the next thing.
Yeah. And the, you know, the, like I said, the big leap that we've got to make there, and this is where Chrome OS, I think, is certainly sort of ahead of the curve, right? But we can see this following in Windows 10. And I suspect based on some changes to Mac hardware, right? I mean, they're now shipping with onboard cryptographic processor.
Secure enclaves and whatnot. Yeah.
But certainly we can sort of foresee, right, that there's potentially some similar changes on the horizon there where that platform ecosystem would also let you get to the point where you can make these strongly attestable certifications that, like, this device is good or it's not. And this is far better, again, back to kind of the original point about, like, you're not likely certainly in anything but the largest enterprises where you have the biggest spend to have 50 people looking at SIM tools and scrolling through alerts. So it's much more useful to have that one very high, very clear signal that something is wrong, and then automatically enact some policy action on it, right? Like, okay, well, Patrick's machine's owned, don't let him access. And then, you know, somebody can go out and work with you to remediate that versus where do I start in the tens of thousands of alerts that you generated today and sort of sift through that. I mean, it's sort of an untenable proposition, especially for a lot of smaller and more agile organizations.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you're singing from the same songbook as Haroon Mir with his Thinks Canary stuff, that's for sure.
Yeah,
high quality signaling, man. You know,
like, I was going to say that's good company to be singing the same song.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, Mike Hanley, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about BeyondCorp and you know, the role of Auth in all of that and all of that good stuff. It's been fun.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Mike Hanley there of Duo Security. Big thanks to Duo for sponsoring this week's show. Do check them out at duo.com. I've dropped a few BeyondCorp links into this week's show notes, and they're definitely worth looking into, even just as a bit of an academic exercise, as an academic study. Read that stuff. It's cool. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.